Exploring the debate between science and religion. This is Seeking Truth, Science, Mystery and Human Identity from St. Paul's Cathedral.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and on behalf of the chapter, may I welcome you to St. Paul's Cathedral this evening. My name is Graham Knowles. I'm the Dean of this cathedral. It means I'm in charge, really, which is why there are five people sitting down and I don't have a chair. It's very good to welcome you here this evening for the second panel discussion in the St. Paul's Institute series, Seeking Truth, Science, Mystery and Human Identity. It's also very good to welcome the distinguished panel. They're the people that do have chairs, and my colleague Ed Newell, who's sitting in the middle, who will introduce them to you in a minute. This evening's discussion is called God and the Universe, and asks, is there a purpose to the universe? The cosmological argument for the existence of God, or a first cause, goes back at least to Greek philosophers such as Plato and Aristotle. In recent decades, new discoveries and theories in astronomy and astrophysics have reawakened interest in what's called the cosmological argument. We gather tonight under our own cosmological thing, the dome. Some of you will have noticed that domes are quite spectacular to look at. They're quite spectacular to worship in, and they're absolutely appalling to hear in. If you have any difficulty, the advice is to move towards the edges. If you spot a speaker, go and sit near it. From the sound of what's happening this evening, we've tuned up a bit on last week. But if you can't hear, please do feel free to move out a little from the centre. It's lovely to be in the middle, but you can't always hear. I'm now going to hand over to Ed Newell, the director of the St. Paul's Institute, who's chairing the debate and who's going to introduce the panel to you. Ed.
Thank you. For those of you who've not been to one of our debates before, let me just explain the format. In a moment, I'm going to ask each of our speakers an opening question, after which we'll move into a panel discussion. And then for the last part of the evening, we'll take questions from the floor. If you have a question, please write it on your leaflet, hold it up, and it'll be collected. And we'll take questions until about 7:20. And please try to keep your questions brief. It's a better chance of them being taken if they're shorter. We'll then end promptly at 8 o'clock. But before you leave, please do visit the bookstall at the back of the cathedral. And please do give generously to the retiring collection for our education department, which works with over 25,000 children who visit St. Paul's each year. You'll have been given a gift aid envelope. If you make your donation in that, please fill in the details on the back. It enables us to reclaim tax on your donation. There's other information about the evening and the whole programme in your white leaflets, including how you can hear a recording of it on Premier Radio this weekend, and also how to get a transcript from our website. If you'd like to find out more about the series, which includes more debates and study days, please fill in the form on the leaflet and hand it in with the retiring collection, or hand it in when you submit a question. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank the Templeton Foundation for their generous sponsorship of this programme. And now it gives me great pleasure to introduce our panel. Starting on my right, Eric Priest is Professor of Theoretical Solar Physics at St Andrews University. A Fellow of the Royal Society, he's also been honoured by the American Astronomical Society. And he's currently running a series of public lectures on science and religion at St Andrews University, which I understand is attracting very large audiences. So tonight's a bit of a busman's holiday for you. Frances Young is Emeritus Professor of Theology at Birmingham University, where she was Pro-Vice-Chancellor, and she is a Methodist minister. A Fellow of the British Academy, she was awarded an OBE in 1998 for services to theology. As well as her work on the New Testament and the early church, she's written on suffering and disability and is involved with the L'Arche community. David Burrell is Professor of Ethics and Development at Uganda Martyrs University, Unkozi, Uganda, and Professor Emeritus of Philosophy and Theology at the University of Notre Dame in America. He's also taught in Jerusalem and Bangladesh, and his field of study is the medieval exchange between Jews, Christians, and Muslims, which has a particular relevance for our times as well. Chris Isham is Professor of Theoretical Physics at Imperial College London and a specialist in quantum gravity and quantum theory. A practicing Christian, he's been involved in dialogue between science and religion for over 20 years, which has led him to participate in seminars in the Vatican. Would you please welcome our panel? The first question is for Eric. Eric, can you explain to us what the Big Bang is, and is it the only scientific theory about the creation of the universe?
Well, if you give me a few billion years, maybe I could answer that question. But I need to make two points before I address that. The first is that there are different worlds. There is a physical world of mass and energy, space and time. There's also a mathematical world in which we discover mathematical truths. There's a world of consciousness, my own consciousness, a consciousness that I share with communities that I'm part of. And then there's also a cosmic consciousness, if you like, a world where ultimate questions can be addressed, which for centuries have engaged philosophers, such as the nature of reality, the origin, the purpose, the destiny of humankind. All of these different worlds are important to me as a human being. And to me, they interact with one another. And I need all of them to go anywhere towards a full understanding of an answer to the kinds of questions we're addressing this evening. The second point, though, is that the world of modern science is quite incredible. It's a wondrous world. It's very much stranger than fiction. There's a mainstream of science, a core of science, which is very well established and which is very unlikely to change, and which you should all accept unless you have good reason not to. There's also, though, a speculative part to science, the newer parts where we're in the process of discovering. That's very tentative, it's open to debate, and it's much less certain. Now, the Big Bang. Well, I prefer to call this the expanding or the unfolding universe. I think that's a much better definition or description than the Big Bang. We know that the whole universe is expanding and cooling from a point about 13.7 billion years ago. At the very early stages, and I mean very early, not a thousandth or a millionth or even a billionth of a second. A billionth of a second would be 1 divided by 10 with 9 zeros. I mean very much smaller than that. 1 divided by 10 with perhaps 30 zeros. If you can imagine such an incredibly small time, those are the times we're starting to think about, where there was just pure energy, there was one unified force. And as the universe expanded from those very early times, the different forces separated out. And first of all, quarks were created, and then protons were created. And by very much later, by perhaps a trillionth of a second, if you can imagine that, 1 divided by 10 with 12 zeros, by a trillionth of the second, the universe that we now see filled a sphere that is roughly the size of the solar system. The temperature at those times was about 10,000 trillion degrees. Anyway, the universe carried on expanding and cooling, and by 3 minutes, all the hydrogen and helium nuclei that exist in the world today, they had all been created by 3 minutes. Later on, by a third of a million years, all the atoms of hydrogen and helium had been created, and the universe became transparent. And we can see back as far as that. We can see the universe glowing at 2.7 degrees. That's the glow of the Big Bang that we can see with telescopes in the cosmic microwave background. Later on, by 1 billion years, the first stars and the first galaxies were formed. And inside these stars, the other elements were formed of which we're made, carbon and nitrogen and so on. Then by 9 billion years, that's 4.7 billion years ago, the Earth was formed. And very, very recently, a million years ago, a twinkling of an eye on the scale of the universe, humans were formed, consciousness was born, human consciousness at least. Now, most of that is very well understood. But what about the more speculative parts? Well, the standard Big Bang cosmology, the standard theory, is based on general relativity. And that suggests that at the moment of the Big Bang, space and time were created from nothing. But the problem is that at those extremely early times, general relativity and quantum mechanics break down. And we need to have a new theory which unites quantum mechanics with gravity, with general relativity. There are two main candidates that have been proposed for that. One is superstring theory, which suggests that elementary particles are not points, but they're tiny strings, very, very tiny strings. And that space has 6 or 7 extra dimensions. Another possibility, another candidate for this new unified theory, is loop quantum gravity. And you have on the other end of the table here the other scientist. He's one of the world experts on this subject of loop quantum gravity. What about the possible implications, though, of this more speculative side? One possible implication is that maybe the Big Bang is not the beginning of time. Maybe there was a before in which the universe collapsed and then bounced. And so maybe it's really a big bounce rather than a big bang that we're seeing. Another possibility is that our universe is actually a three-dimensional membrane floating, cruising through a higher dimensional space. And that the Big Bang is actually the collision of two of these three-dimensional membranes. Another possibility is that maybe the universe is not just expanding, but it's oscillating. It's expanding and contracting. And yet again, another possibility is that there are many other universes, not just our own, many other universes that are spawned inside black holes. Well, all these possibilities that I've just mentioned, these four possibilities, are highly speculative. There's no evidence whatsoever at the moment for them. But in future, perhaps they will be ruled out by observations from, for example, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, or by the new Planck space satellite. Maybe some of these will be ruled out. Maybe some of them will become part of mainstream science. We don't know.
Thank you very much indeed. That's given us a few things to think about. Maybe we can get a few more things to think about. Turning to Francis Young. Francis, Genesis contains two stories of creation that are woven together. The first one, the 7 days of creation, focuses on creation of the cosmos. What does this account of creation convey?
I want to suggest that the story as told in Genesis conveys four things, and then I want to make a general comment about the interpretation of that particular section of Scripture. So the first and most important thing, which I'm not going to enlarge very much, this story tells us that everything issues from God's will to create, and the whole thing is very good in God's eyes. That's first. I want to underline it because I'm not going to expand it. Everything results from God's will to create, and the whole thing is, in God's eyes, very good. The second thing which this account suggests is the absolute priority of God. Now, there is a certain element in the story which might suggest a kind of struggle between cosmos and chaos. Cosmos, the original Greek word cosmos, means an ordered reality, which is beautiful. And chaos means a great abyss, a depth of nondescript, goodness knows what, probably dark, very dark. And probably this kind of tension in the story between cosmos and chaos was a kind of rationalization of ancient Near Eastern mythologies in which a creating God struggled with a monster of the deep. In other parts of the Bible, we find reference to Leviathan. We find reference in ancient mythologies to a kind of sea dragon. And the struggle with this monster of the deep was what enabled the God to create. Now, if you look at the first chapter of Genesis, all such sea monsters have been reduced to creatures. Verse 21 of Genesis chapter 1, God created great sea monsters. The priority of God is thus established. I want to add two more comments. It is probable that when verse 2 talks about the Spirit of God moving over the chaos creatively, it doesn't mean a single one-off event. It does imply that the Spirit of God is constantly at work, bringing cosmos out of chaos, good out of evil. That's the first point. And there are other parts of the Bible which suggest a kind of constant creativity. The second point is that the earliest Christian apologists identified that chaos with the unformed matter or material substrate of Platonic philosophy. Creation out of nothing emerged probably in the second century after Christ. It is not explicit in the Genesis text. Once the question was posed, the alternatives were set out as follows. God did not create out of the divine self, or everything would be divine. God did not create out of something, some substrate or matter, or else there would be two eternal divine first principles, and God's monarchia would be threatened. I use the Greek word monarchia because it has a double meaning. It means monarchy or sovereignty, but it also means single first principle. So, if God did not create out of something, God must have created out of nothing, nothing. And this was seen to be the appropriate implication of Genesis' emphasis on God's priority. It isn't explicit in the text, but it seems to be the right implication of the text. The third thing the story is about, I think, is the position of humanity within the natural order. Humanity is created at the end of the 6 days as a kind of steward, caretaker, or gardener. When the authorized version translated "have dominion over," it was actually translating a word which means shepherd. Exploitation of the natural world was not what Genesis understood. Genesis understood humanity's place among creatures, part of the natural order. And so did early Christians, who noticed that humanity is the crown of creation and had a kind of double nature, the potential to be bestial, like the animals, or to be angelic. Now, since Darwin, we've had the question, apes or angels? There are many texts in the Bible which acknowledge that human beings are no different from the animals. There is, in fact, a classic in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. The fate of humans and the fate of animals is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath, and humans have no advantage over the animals. I wish somebody had noticed that when arguing with Darwin. In the Genesis narrative, God creates humanity, humankind, as a kind of vice-regent in God's own image and likeness. And that phrase is a counter to idolatry. The word for image is the word that was used for idols or gods made in human or animal form. Genesis is saying the only image and likeness of God is the human person, and human beings are set in creation as gardeners, shepherds, caretakers to act on God's behalf. The fourth thing that's built into this story is an explanation or justification of keeping the Sabbath. That is the shape of the text. For 6 days God created, on the seventh day God rested. Now, I think it's very important to realize that those 6 days were never taken literally in early Christian exegesis. People asked questions like, how could there be days before the sun was created? Or they pointed to that text, 1,000 ages in thy sight are like an evening gone. Augustine, one of the great early expositors in the 4th century, suggested that time was created with the creation, and creation was one simultaneous event, as stated in the first verse of Genesis. And the sequence and order of the days points to other truths. They point to God's purposes. They point to moral and spiritual development. They're not to be taken literally, but they point to spiritual realities. The text points beyond itself. So to conclude, I want to underline this point. The Genesis text was never taken as scientifically literal. Early Christians noted the silences of Scripture. They noted it never speaks about the creation of matter. It never speaks about the four elements, which were then the current scientific orthodoxy. The point of the text is not to encourage speculation about origins, but to signal God's purposes. And so, in a way, protology, that is the study of beginnings, reflects eschatology, the study of ends. It's what it's all leading up to that's really important. And on a Christian reading, this was seen to be anticipated in Christ. The phrase in this story, God said, "Let there be," was interpreted according to Psalm 33:6, by the word of the Lord the heavens were made. In early Christianity, they then pointed to John chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning was the Word, all things were made through him. And so the Word of God incarnate in Jesus is already present at the beginning in creation, as is the Spirit of God moving on the face of the waters, of the chaos waters, as we mentioned earlier. And so the Word of God incarnate in Jesus later but pre-existing, and the Spirit of God are the two hands of God through whom God created. The Trinity was read into the first verse of the chapter of Genesis. Genesis was read theologically, not literally.
Thank you very much. David, just to pick up on one theme which was mentioned by Francis, Christianity, Judaism and Islam share the view that God creates ex nihilo, that's out of nothing. Would you like to expand on this, please?
I'd be happy to. Two summers ago, I was privileged to assist Janet Soskius and Bill Steger at the Vatican Observatory, gathering representatives of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim faiths, we call it collectively the Abrahamic faiths, to reflect on creation ex nihilo. Our consummately collegial discussion in that fabled place above the city of Rome has helped me to begin, even to begin to reflect on a topic as daunting as the origin and destiny of the universe. Now, the undeniable fact that any human inquiry is animated from the outset by a quest for the good and the true fairly encapsulates what these three traditions have to say about the origin of the universe from a free creator. Indeed, even to reflect on the origin and destiny of the universe, our title for this evening, presumes a giant step beyond the Greeks, whose originary reflections on the world in which we live as the universe could blithely presume its very existence. And understandably so, since things that normally capture our attention are the things that move. Sitting in a garden where bushes and trees are titillated by a light breeze, we're attracted by the glint of changing colors. We can then be brought, of course, to recognize that living things are always growing or decaying, and so will ever be marked by an imperceptible yet vital movement. That recognition can motivate a child to become a scientist. What is really going on? Yet however sophisticated the explanatory hypotheses we employ to try to understand what really is going on, we will remain this side of the Abrahamic faith's insistence that God creates all this ex nihilo. Because, as Francis has reminded us, the intellectual traditions associated with these faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, elaborate their terse revelational statements, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, or the Quran even more lapidary, God said be, and it is, as the divine agent granting things their very existence instantaneously, so without that process of coming to be which we associate with everything we know. Indeed, that is what ex nihilo comes to. No pre-existing conditions, so no traceable process. To be sure, the existence granted will have to be an ordered existence, since there can be no brute facts. And that is a presumption underlying all scientific inquiry. So sophisticated inquiries into what is really going on will all concern themselves with the dynamics of the movements we notice, seeking to formulate the regularities which help us to understand what is going on in these movements. And that is what scientific inquiry is about. But what impels us to go on with it? An abiding hope of discovery. A hope continually nourished, to be sure, by progress and understanding. Yet can we ask where that hope itself comes from? And I shall suggest that that's what we really mean by creation ex nihilo. And it is this reflective step that makes all the difference. Asking ourselves where the hope of further understanding comes from. Identifying it as we must with an intelligibility always in front of us. And asking us where it comes from. One need not to take that step, of course. Inquirers can simply be propelled by field-specific concerns or even by career goals. And this would be as natural as our noticing the movements of the bushes and trees while overlooking or simply presuming their very existence. For it is what is going on that initially fascinates us, and what hope we have of understanding what is really going on will have to rest in hypotheses that we can formulate and test. While the origins of the ordered existence which admittedly undergirds all this inquiry will quite escape us. And that is all to the good, the Abrahamic traditions say, which elaborate creation ex nihilo. For the one God bestowing ordered existence cannot leave any traces. There can be no way of finding the Creator's footsteps in creation. For existence is not a discernible feature of things. It's not a feature we can explain like a problem to be solved. But rather a mystery which gradually insinuates itself into our awareness, emerging, as we have seen, in reflective moments like asking ourselves where this hope of understanding comes from. We know we have stumbled onto a mystery when we realize we are faced with a question we must honor but cannot answer. Yet this all-important distinction is crucial to a proper understanding of what the Abrahamic traditions call creation ex nihilo. For if we could find traces of a creator in creation, as the intelligent divine design devotees presume they can, then the creator would be a cause like other causes in creation. And that we know, and Francis has reminded us, cannot be the case.
Thank you very much. Chris Isham, do you think there is a divinely determined meaning and purpose embedded in the universe?
Let me repeat this question back to you. Do I think there's a divinely determined meaning and purpose embedded in the universe? When I got sent this question, I almost sent it back at once and said, ask me another. Well, I thought, well, why not? Okay, let's ask them the question seriously. But the question is, why ask me the question? I'm a theoretical physicist. Am I the person who has authority to speak on this question? I'm reminded of Socrates' famous discussion about who's the expert on goodness. He would have said, if you want to ask about how shoes are made, you'd ask a cobbler. But who do you ask about goodness? And in the same way, who is qualified to answer this question? Is it me? Is it my two theologian friends? Or three, actually, on the right? Is it Eric? Well, that's an interesting question to think about. I'm a theoretical physicist, and as Erica said, I specialize in fact, things to do with the quantum creation of the universe, and especially, actually, the way in which modern scientific theories do remarkably interface with the theological concept of creatio ex nihilo. It's actually quite fascinating that how it works. I've also lectured a lot on Jung's ideas in modern physics. And I expect to be asked one of these things. No. I was asked, do I think there's a divine purpose? All right, so what type of answer is expected? Now, I could just say yes, and then go off and just come back for the free dinner we get later on, but okay, I'm not going to do that. Now, my hero Jung, very famously towards the end of his life, has a very famous interview on the BBC, where the interviewer said to him, do you believe in God? Which, after all, is not dissimilar to the question I'm being asked, actually. And Jung said, I don't believe, I know. And this was very much quoted and had a big impact on people interested in these things at the time. Later on, however, Jung said what he really meant was that in his psychoanalytical study of his patients, which was towards many, many people, he often found the image of God embedded deeply in his clients' psyches. Now, actually, he believed more than that, but that's what he said he meant by the answer. Now, that, you see, is a rather, in a sense, a bit of a cheat, because what he's done is he's turned a question about belief. You could ask the most profound question of belief you could ask. It was actually a scientific question, because he could do a statistical analysis, I suppose, of Jung's patients and see how many actually did have the image of God in their psyches and how many didn't. So it becomes a scientific question. So can I do the same trick here as a well-experienced academic? Can I slide around the question and turn it to something which I can answer? Well, what does the question actually mean? Let me split it into two. The first bit of the question says, is there a meaning / purpose embedded in the universe? Question number one, if so, is it divinely determined? So it's two different questions, really. Now, meaning / purpose are, of course, very human concepts. If I may, I would like to slightly finesse that and change it to, is there a structure in the universe? Now, the answer to that is yes, most certainly there is. In fact, it's extraordinary, as Eric has remarked already, at how incredibly structured the world is. And it's mathematics at a very fundamental level seems to underpin everything. And it is quite extraordinary, but it seems to be true. So, yes, there is a structure. If so, is it divinely determined? Let me finesse this slightly and say, if so, is it compatible with theism? Now, if I'm allowed to make these two slightly slippery moves, I've turned it into a scientific question with theological overtones. As a matter of fact, I've been to many conferences and workshops on science and religion, and actually they're always about this. Is there a structure in the universe? If so, is it compatible with theism? What sort of theological school is perhaps most consistent in modern science? That's a question you can ask and has been asked. Now, the best answer to that is that the theological school that's most consistent in modern science is actually atheism. Now, I'm not an atheist, I'm a Christian, but as far as I can see, the modern science of matter, that, is totally consistent with being just that, atheism. In that sense, Dawkins has a point. However, of course, I don't believe that, and the last 20 years particularly have seen intense discussions amongst people who work in this sort of field to try and find a view, a common philosophical position for discussing both theology and particularly modern physics, which is one of my big interests. A friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, John Polkinghorne, is very well known for his work in this area, and others have developed what they call critical realism, which is a kind of philosophical view which they think allows you to talk about both science and religion at the same time. Now, I always say to John, if he's a critical realist, I'm a mystical idealist. And so it's just half joke and half not joke. And in fact, the answer to the question, which I will give right at the very end with the chairman's permission, is actually based on that. You see, if you're not allowed to change meaning to structure, and now I ask this question to you now very seriously, what can a scientist possibly say? It comes back to what I said at the beginning. Scientists have no qualifications whatsoever for answering the question about divine purpose. Matter of fact, many of you in the audience may be better qualified than me. If you have a more spiritual perception of the world, if you're Christians or any other religion for that matter, you may be better qualified than I am. I'll just say this one thing, and then of course discuss this more later, is that this type of a question has led me very much to a fundamental question which actually arises in all of these discussions and includes also modern science, modern physics particularly, which is what are the appropriate categories of thought with which to study the world? You just cannot imagine how much people don't think about this when they should. There's this enormous tendency to take for granted that what works over here in this realm of reality is going to work over there. Now, the philosopher Kant very famously warned against this, what he called category errors, but we do it all the time. And my colleagues, particularly the theoretical physicists, are absolutely terrible at that. And I think if you're going to ask these questions seriously, you have to address this. I mean, when we ask about divine purpose, what do we really mean? But anyway, let me stop at this point and say right at the end, if you're interested, I'll answer the question. If not, we'll leave it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chris, you used the word compatibility. And I think that's something I'd just like to start to tease out a bit, the compatibility of the concept of the Big Bang, or whatever we want to call it this evening, and the concept of creation ex nihilo. Because I think part of what we're trying to do is bring theology and science together this evening. That seems to be something we ought to focus on. So can I start by asking a question, and beginning with Professor Young on this, to tease it out a bit. Whether a theologian saying that God creates out of nothing is equivalent to a scientist saying the universe emerged, say, out of a quantum vacuum. Is a vacuum nothing, or is a vacuum something, or are these completely different ways of looking at things?
Well, I can certainly say a little more about what I think creation out of nothing means for us as theologians, which might then relate to the other half of your question, where I'm less qualified. In the early church, I've indicated the eventual series of logical arguments that were used to suggest that creation took place out of nothing. But there was also another argument that kept being brought out. A human being, when a human being creates, say a sculptor creating some great sculpture, then the matter, the material, the stone, the wood is already there. And what the human craftsman does is to shape matter or material that is already there. Now, the first argument we find for creation out of nothing is that God shows how much greater God is than a human being by not only creating the thing, but also creating the matter out of which the thing is constituted. Now, it seems to me that when you actually start thinking about creation out of nothing, you have to go further than that. That is a kind of extension of what I will call the craftsman analogy. But if you think about God as being infinite, if anything is to exist which is other than God, God has to, as it were, voluntarily withdraw. I'm using a spatial analogy because we have to use what we know about to talk about what we don't know about. Now, if God has to withdraw in order for something other than God to exist at all, then Simone Weil, the 20th century mystic, said creation is an act of abandonment. And it seems to me that that is actually a teasing statement which we need to think very seriously about, because one of the things that is clear is that creation out of nothing desacralizes the universe. If you like, the gods or God is no longer intertwined with the universe. God is absolutely transcendent and other. And that means that any God talk is an analogy, a parable. It can't absolutely correspond with a God who is totally other than anything created, and everything we know is created. In the early church, they were very careful to say that if you think you can comprehend God, you have reduced God to the size of your own mind. So I want to throw these out as teasing thoughts, which actually make us realize that creation out of nothing means we can't use the craftsman analogy anymore at all. And God's creativity is something quite beyond us.
Yes, I agree that it's something completely beyond us, and it's something much more mysterious than we would normally mean by creation. Normally creation is an activity in time. You start out with a canvas and then you create a painting as time proceeds. But here we're talking about something that is beyond time, that is outside time. And also, what do you mean by nothing? Because normally you think of a vacuum as being nothing, but Chris on the end there, who is our expert in quantum mechanics, will tell you that something with quantum fluctuations, a seething volume of potentiality, is not exactly nothing, I suspect. Is that right, Chris?
I'll speak in a minute. Go on, sorry.
You carry on. You tell us what a vacuum is.
That's the battle.
I guess I can do my bit, right. As you've kind of picked up already, historically, there are two kind of quite different perspectives which the ancient philosophers and theologians evolved. One is the creation out of a pre-existing something. In modern scientific terms, we would probably say pre-existing space and time. Sort of thing you have in Newtonian physics, actually. So space and time are always there, and the universe suddenly pops out in the middle by some act of some craftsman, some demiurge, someone who works on what's already there. So this is creation out of the potentiality being. Now, that's the Babylonian view, actually, which the Christian church doesn't like at all. And actually, if I may gently chide our chairman, if you really created out of the quantum vacuum, that would be Babylonian, not Christian. That's actually creating out of something that's already there. Now, how can you create out of nothing? Well, nothing. The word nothing, of course, means no thing, obviously. So there's no things there. How could you do this? Can you really talk about the creation of time, for example? Is that really possible? Yes, the answer is it is, for reasons that sound perhaps a bit surprising, because you see, the word create is a verb. Now, English language, like all languages, has tensed verbs, but tensed has to do with time. So built into our very language is some prima facie view about the nature of time. But it's the wrong category of thought to use here. This is one of the hardest things to do when you work in this area, is to realize that the ordinary way we talk about the world simply doesn't apply. And in fact, once you get around to a rule about it, you can talk about the creation of time. Now, people always ask me, well, what was there before the Big Bang? See? And the answer is, well, there wasn't a was, you see, because there wasn't any time at all. The verbs break down. The whole thing mathematically works on the equation naught equals naught, actually. You see, you might think, how can you create the world out of nothing? Because, look, I jump up and down, energy. All you people, masses and masses of energy. Right? Where's it all come from? Now, the intriguing answer is yes, although it's true, there's lots and lots of energy. There's also negative energy caused by the gravitational field. Everything has... The reason why things fall, because the energy is negative. And if you do the calculation, guess what? They exactly cancel. So the total energy of the universe is actually nothing. I mean zero. Sorry, zero. Now, what's the energy of nothing? Well, what could it be? Zero. So actually, you have conservation of energy. So naught equals naught. So no universe is nothing. Sorry, zero. Universe is also zero. Now, I'm not actually joking when I say this. And this is why, in fact, it is possible scientifically to try to talk about scientific versions of the things my two theological colleagues here have been discussing. It's quite intriguing. I'll stop because I could talk about this for hours.
let's just pick up a bit about space and time and perhaps have a theological perspective on this from David. But when we talk about God being beyond space and time, how do you understand that?
It picks up a number of the themes here that what we really mean by creation ex nihilo is no pre-existing conditions. We all know what those are, right? And the fact that God creates the universe means it does not do it as a process, but has to do it, if it is done at all, it has to be instantaneous and immediate. One of the ways of expressing this is the wonderful metaphor of my friend Jim Ross, a philosophical theologian at University of Pennsylvania, who said that the universe is like the song and the breath of a singer.
So God's creating is itself non-temporal, because God is not in time, but at each instant, as it were, the being of things, the very existence of things, emerges from, as Francis reminded us, the divine intellected will.
Thank you. Eric, would you like to pick up on that?
We're talking here about space and time, but space and time are both much stranger than we think at first sight. For example, we have the feeling that time is flowing in three-dimensional space. There's a flow of time. And yet, that's really just a subjective feeling. Is it what's really happening? The relation between space and time is actually much more complex than that. Also, we have the feeling that space and time are both continuous, and that events are determined in time. But that's not quite true, because space is probably granular at a very fine scale. It's not continuous. And there's also a random element to the nature of reality. I think that in the old days, Laplace, for example, used to talk about a mechanistic universe, a universe which was running like clockwork almost, where you set it up and then everything is determined thereafter. But that's not the modern understanding of the nature of reality, the nature of matter, because in a sense there are intrinsic probabilities present. There's a statistical nature to reality, both at a very fine scale, quantum, on a quantum level, but there's also uncertainty on the kind of level that we're involved in. For example, it will never be possible for weather forecasters to predict the weather more than maybe 1 week ahead, because however big our computers are, there are little unpredictable eddies which can grow into massive storms, which you can't predict in advance. It's called chaos theory, modern chaos theory. There's this element to reality which is not as determined as we used to think it was.
Thank you. I'm picking up on that. You're talking about mechanistic universe. There's this huge difference between sort of the Newtonian view of the universe, fixed, well-ordered, regulated, harmonious, and one which is expanding, changing, possibly with a beginning, possibly with an end. And just picking up on that, how do we respond to that sort of cosmology theologically? What sort of implications does this have for our understanding of God? Perhaps we could start with you, Francis, on that.
I think I want to go back to what I was saying before, that there's a real sense in which we have to almost conceive of God letting go in order to allow something to be which is other than God. And if we look at, to move into another area of science, things like evolutionary theory and so on, it is clear that there is a very considerable amount of randomness in the universe. And at one level, the universe works according to a kind of inbuilt rationality. At another level, that rationality is not fixed and determined. The universe has a kind of life of its own, which we can't actually predict. Now, it seems to me that this idea that somehow God has to withdraw in order to allow something other than God to exist helps us at this point, because, you know, we sometimes sing he's got the whole world in his hands in some Christian gatherings. But if you wanted to hold a butterfly, how would you do it? If you took hold of a butterfly, you would damage it. And the only way to hold it is to do this and have the butterfly free within that. And maybe that is a kind of parable of how we have to think about God's relationship with his creation, that God has, as it were, allowed the creation to be what it will be.
Chris, would you like to pick up on any of those points?
Yes, I can only make a few remarks. It's actually worse than you think about space and time. One thing one has to get used to in science, particularly physics, is the understanding that a sort of category of thought, a way of describing the world which works at one scale, will break down to another. There's not a uniform, homogeneous sense of concepts. And I would guess that most people who work in this field would actually agree with me that, as far as time is concerned, the concept of time that we're talking about here, which is the ordinary notion of time, is very likely very much like temperature. Now, temperature, you see, you're talking about the temperature of something. But where does temperature come from? Why is something hot? The reason why it's hot is all the molecules in there are zipping around at high speeds. And if you touch it, they bang you, and energy is communicated to you. Now, if you start asking about temperature at the individual molecular level, it doesn't mean anything anymore. So temperature as a concept only works if you look at things in the large. Now, there's a fairly widespread belief that time is like that too. So when you're talking about the origin of the universe, it's a great mistake to use concepts of time that actually come from Newtonian physics. So, for example, you said about instantaneous. But you see, the word instantaneous is a temporal one.
Of course. Same time.
And in fact, I'm not saying the scientific theories are right, of course, they may well be wrong. But the way they deal with that is that time itself doesn't exist at that point. So you don't have temporal concepts at all. They merge later on, just as temperature emerges. So these are very tricky waters you get into if you really start taking these things seriously, scientifically. As far as Newton versus GR is concerned, I've noticed in all these various meetings I've been to that there's a tendency amongst the theologians who work in this field to say that Newtonian physics is consistent with classical theism or deism, the traditional view of the relation of God to space and time. So God stands completely outside the fabric of space and time. They tend to say, and I think my colleagues rightly won't agree with this, but they tend to say that general relativity is compatible with process theology. I've noticed people tend to say that, where God is part, built right into the very nature and evolution of the world. So that's my comments on that.
Yes, so just what is the relationship between God and the universe where we live? What's his relationship to space and time? And the old idea, as you say, Chris, was that God is, in a sense, outside space and time and is looking down on the whole of space and time, so he can see everything everywhere that ever was and ever will be. This was the old idea of a kind of block universe. But I think, to me, that isn't completely satisfactory, because what happens to free will? I mean, do I decide to raise my arm or not? Does God know I'm going to decide to or not? I feel that I do have free will. And so maybe, I don't know, maybe God is partly in time and partly outside time. Maybe he partly knows what's going to happen. Maybe he knows the global, the general trends of what's going to happen, but not the actual particularities. I don't know. It's a mystery to me.
It's good not to know that. It's just as Chris called me on instantaneous, which is, of course, a temporal term. We have no other choice. All that kind of speculation about God is short of idolatry, it seems to me. Because the fact is that the relationship between God and the universe has to be sui generis, because God and the universe are not two separate things. The universe comes forth from God in such a way as to be non-duality with God. That is, God is not separate from the universe, cannot be, because God keeps it into existence. Yet, as Francis used the image, God so lets it be that the universe is distinct from God. Now, how we can explain that in terms of the relationship between you and me, we can't. So it's a relationship which is sui generis.
And yet God has given us minds to think, and he wants us to think about his universe. He wants us to ponder. He wants us to discover.
Sure.
This is an urge that we have. It's a creative urge. And I think this comes from God. I think it's, you know, God wants us to learn more about the wonderful nature of his universe.
Sure,
and he wants us to wrestle with our minds over these questions.
But as we keep reminding ourselves, we can't engage in the kind of imaginative projections that take place within the universe when we're thinking about the relationship with God and the universe.
Ultimately, it's a mystery. I agree. And we have to look at it with great humility.
I think I know what we're going to be talking about over dinner. in a moment, we're going to move into questions from the floor. But just one final question for our discussion, really to pick up on a term that Frances used when she talked about protology and leading into eschatology. And I'm talking about protology leading into eschatology. And the book of Revelation talks about end times, and science suggests very clearly that the world will come to an end by one of a number of mechanisms. And how might the image of the new creation in the book of Revelation relate to this? Perhaps, Frances, you'd like to kick off on that.
Perhaps I could say a little bit about the biblical and early Christian debates about some of these issues, which sets a bit of a context for understanding it in a different kind of scientific universe, if I can put it that way. You see, the classical philosophy that was around tended to assume either that the universe was eternal or that there was a kind of cyclical going round and round and round, so that, you know, in some long-term rerun of everything, I will be sitting here doing this in front of you all over again, and this will happen time and time and time again. So we have these two views of the whole thing being eternal or being cyclical, and the Christians found themselves having to argue against this in saying that everything had a beginning, and of course if everything has a beginning, it will also have an end. And they challenged the current kind of philosophy about things on that basis. And the interesting thing is how, in thinking about creation out of nothing and thinking about the purpose of the universe, they would then see in the creation story kind of pointers to that purpose and that end. That, if you like, God calls things, us, the universe, into being out of nothing, which is a process of change. And then there is an ongoing process of change and maturing through the kinds of things we do, the mistakes we make, the risks we take, the outcomes. We learn and mature. And eventually, given that things somehow seem to go wrong in all of that process, God will actually bring this current world, as it were, to an end, and his full purposes will be worked out in a new creation, which for Christians is anticipated in Jesus Christ. And how exactly that relates to current scientific understanding of the universe, I think, is a teasing, interesting problem. But I think at the heart of Christianity, there is this sense of hope. Because God is creator, God can also be the one who recreates and enables what has been created to reach its full fulfillment, even though that fulfillment involves going through a kind of end and a reconstitution.
Thank you, David.
I've been quite fascinated the way the Quran handles this business of creation. It's out of nothing on the one hand, and of course the resurrection on the other hand. And it does it in a wonderful way. It says, you don't believe the resurrection? Can the one who created the universe out of nothing not resurrect the entire universe at the end? Or it says, you don't believe in creation ex nihilo? Can the one who resurrected the universe at the end not create it? So in other words, it stands and falls together.
Thank you very much. We're now going to move into questions from the floor. Here's one for our scientists on either side. It's clearly a question that a lot of people have asked in various ways. And the question is, how can a scientist also be a Christian?
For me, that's very easy and it's very natural because as a scientist, being a scientist is very important to me. This is what I am. This is what I am in my core. But being a scientist is probably quite different from what you think it is. It's not a matter of being coldly logical, being in a white coat, being like a robot, being arrogant. That is not what science is about. And if you see a scientist looking like that, looking arrogant or closed in his thinking, then you know he's not a real scientist, right? To me, being a scientist is all, the essence of it is about openness, being open, being creative, using imagination, expecting that your ideas are going to change in time. So that, in a sense, is very similar to me to the life of faith, to being a Christian. And it has huge implications on my life as a Christian. That approach to being from science, I learn to wonder about the world, and that takes me outside myself. It makes me appreciate that there is a lot more to the universe or to life than purely scientific things. There are many things that are really important to me as a scientist: beauty, love, and science can say nothing about those things.
Chris, would you like to respond to the question?
Well, I agree with everything Eric has said, except one thing. In my experience, many scientists are actually extremely arrogant. Now, maybe that's just Imperial College, I don't know. If that's... I can assure you it's true there. In fact, it's a curious thing. In our physics department where I work, we have a staff of about 80, and I suppose about 6 of those are Christians. There aren't any Muslims, as it happens, or anything else. This is 6 people out of 80. And I'm the only one who has ever got involved in the debate between science and religion, in a scientist's professional sense. And as far as I can see, they live a totally schizoid life. Unlike what Eric was saying, actually, that they, okay, maybe this is Imperial College ethos, but they may have quite deep religious beliefs, but they separate them completely in their minds from their scientific work. Now, part of my answer to the question I was recently asked, actually, is that I only became a Christian when I was 40 years old. In fact, I was baptized and confirmed simultaneously on my 40th birthday. Now, if you ask what was I doing the rest of the time, well, I was having mystical feelings, is the answer. But when I did finally decide that I could authentically call myself a Christian, I thought I must do something about this, because my students, who knew this, kept asking me. They said, how can you, a theoretical physicist, be a Christian? It doesn't make any sense, you see. So I thought, well, rather than just saying, well, I am, and I feel mystical, and there you are, why don't you try and address the issue? And that's what started me personally on this last 20 years when I've been working on science and religion on the side, but I really take an interest in it. It's a very difficult question, actually, because, I mean, I know Eric is deeply religious, and has been probably all his life, yes, since he was a boy, I guess, a long time ago.
Well, I came from a family that was not Christian. In fact, my father wanted to have a quiet Sunday afternoon, so he shoved me off to the local Sunday school on a Sunday afternoon. And then while I was at university, actually, I became much more interested in Christianity, and and I was the first person in my family to be confirmed, and then later on my mother and several other people in my family were confirmed. So I certainly didn't grow up in a Christian, but I did grow up in a loving environment. You know, I think many people actually who do not call themselves Christians nevertheless are experiencing without realizing it the love of God.
Can I just, I'm intrigued to ask this question, Eric, but is St. Andrew's as godless as imperial?
I don't think quite so godless, no.
We pride ourselves on it, actually.
I mean, I moved up to Scotland about 40 years ago, and I absolutely love it up there. To some extent, it's a more conservative society, and so I think there's a bigger attendance at church and so on. But it's a very vibrant Christian society. There's lots of questioning. I should also, let me just add in answer to that question, I think science answers many important questions to me, but it does not answer all of them. There are many other things that are important to me that it does not answer. It does not answer, what is my purpose in life? You know, what should my aim in life be? How can I love my wife better? You know, how can I love my children better and my friends? It doesn't answer these questions.
Thank you very much. This is a question that's directed to Francis, but I hope that David also will come in on this one. If everything God creates is good, how would Francis Young explain the problem of evil and suffering?
I anticipated that somebody might come up with that question, and I congratulate the floor for fulfilling my prediction. I can assure you that this is a question which I wrestled with at a personal level for a very long time. My firstborn son, now in his 40s, was born with profound disabilities as a result of the placenta being insufficient, and he was deprived of oxygen in the womb and nourishment, so that he was a full-term baby but premature weight. In his 40s, he still needs total care and has probably the intellectual understanding of about a 12-month-old baby, and he has no language, no self-help skills, etc. We still support him at home. So you can imagine that the question about this has been one that has exercised me very considerably. And I think there are two things that are important. One is this sense that God doesn't directly arrange everything. You see, my big question was, how can something go so fundamentally wrong in the creation of a new human being if human beings are created with some kind of moral purpose? And I exercised myself over that for a very long time. And it wasn't so much why me as why at all. And gradually I came to realize that one of the really important things that we find in the Bible is an absolutely realistic acceptance that all flesh is grass, we are part of the natural order, things go wrong. In the autumn, the leaves change color, wither and come off. And in the autumn of our lives, we go through something somewhat similar. And just as accidents happen, so accidents can happen even while the embryo is in the womb. And this vulnerability, this frailty, this being a creature as part of the created order is something fundamental about our being as human beings, which I'm afraid our society is in danger of forgetting, and hence the pressures on the NHS. Then there's a further stage. Not only do we have to accept that we are part of a created order, which has these frailties built in. This experience has, it seems to me, been a kind of sacrament in which I have increasingly found that I have privileged access to the deepest truths of Christianity. Let's start with a simple one. St. Paul speaks of the fruits of the Spirit. They're love, joy, peace, patience, goodness, kindness, faithfulness, da-da-da-dum-dum, and self-control. Somebody once said, if you can recite the list, you're halfway there. Well, you can see I'm not even halfway there. But what I would say is that it is in relationship with my son and with other persons with learning disabilities, and through the life of the L'Arche communities founded by Jean Vanier, where people commit themselves to living in community with those who have these kinds of disabilities. It's in those contexts that I have discovered the truth about the fruits of the Spirit. In one of the meetings held in the L'Arche communities over the past decade or so, in which we've reflected on these things, someone said, you know the Descartes thing, I think, therefore I am. Well, this one was, I smile, therefore you are. And when my son smiles, it just takes away all the stress and the pressures of the kind of professional life I've lived at a very, very profound level. But I said the deepest truths of Christianity. It seems to me that one of the things that Christianity says is that, strangely and in a way which we find very difficult to understand, it was God's own self, which in Jesus came and took responsibility for all the, what I call, gone wrongness in the creation. The fact that we do wicked things, that things go wrong, that there is suffering and hurt and all kinds of terrible things that happen, that somehow in Jesus, God took responsibility for that. And through that, we can know that at heart, even though he didn't damage it by grabbing it like that butterfly, the whole world is in the hands of God.
Thank you. David, would you like to add anything to that?
I think everyone here would agree that we can't improve on that.
Sure. Here's a question for everyone, and perhaps starting with you, David, on this one. What contributions have religion made to science?
Well, as I tried to say, the very fact that people are drawn to inquire about the universe, and the very fact that we continue to trust and believe that we will find some intelligibility as we continue to go through the various obstacles that stand in the way of understanding a particular inquiry, that, it seems to me, is where the belief in a creator actually sustains and encourages and inspires scientific inquiry as it began in the Muslim world two or three centuries before it began in the Western world. The development of science was indeed a response on the part of human beings whom the Quran calls God's stewards or vicegerents of creation. It was a response on our part to understanding the gift that we have been given.
Thank you. Eric, would you like to add?
I would like to add something as a postscript to the suffering question, actually. I mean, I do agree Francis's answer was deeply moving. But there are one or two more aspects. I mean, I feel that much of the suffering that we see in the world, and there's so much around us, is actually, if we're honest, our fault. It's the fault of humanity. There's a lot of suffering that we could relieve. If each one of us was kinder, there would be less suffering in the world. In Africa, the huge suffering there, we could do a lot more to help. In fact, one of my sons is devoting his life working out in Africa, helping farmers with crops to grow them better. But there's other suffering which does not seem to be our fault. For example, a tsunami. Well, the tsunami is due to the motion of tectonic plates, and the motion of these plates is amazing, and it's all part of the vibrant activity of the Earth. The way in which the Earth has been formed, the way in which our atmosphere has been formed, is largely affected by the motion of these tectonic plates. If there were no such motion, life would not exist as we know it on Earth. So, in a mysterious way, God has set up this world in which evolution, another example would be evolution, right, which gives rise to amazing complexity, amazing vitality of life, and yet it can also give rise to a cancer when cells go wrong. It's as if God has set up this amazing world with its potentiality, but coupled in with that is the potential for suffering. The suffering and the joy are intertwined. There is an essential part of this world. We can't grab them apart. Suffering and joy is something that we all experience as human beings. We can't have just one or just the other. They're both there. And to me, of all the religions, the one where suffering is right at the core is Christianity. Jesus on the cross. And what does that mean? Essentially, to me, it means that in our suffering, God is alongside us.
Thank you. Chris, any contributions of religion to science?
Yes, it's an interesting question, though, because if you think about it, in practice, the growth of science has been deeply linked, obviously, with the growth of society in general. And in turn, the growth of society has been deeply linked, in fact, to the various major world religions that have existed. That's clearly true in the Western world. The interesting question is, what would have happened if Muhammad had never been, if the Buddha had never been, if Christ had never been? How would society have evolved and how would science have evolved? Would it be that much different? It's an interesting question. You see, people often say, at least people who talk about space and time and so on, that in fact, the Western notion of time, which Newton had, which we've inherited, is actually derived from the concepts of the early Christian church. That the old Greek notion of cyclical time, which was really the dominant paradigm, was actually changed to linear time by the early Christian theologians, for theological reasons. And we've now come to take that for granted. But you see, you have to be terribly careful about what you take things for granted, as I said earlier. So I think in that sense, because there is a way in which certain theological ideas are stamped irreducibly in our Western philosophy and hence in our science. That's just what I would say about that.
In a moment I'm going to ask our speakers to give us a little thought for the day to take away with us. But before I do that, there's just one last question I'd like to ask them and ask all of them. Is prayer a wave, a particle, or something else? Anyone like to have a go at that one?
I once had a debate with John Polkinghorne about more or less the same issue. This was serious. It was one of his Vatican meetings. And it was to do with the nature of prayer and the theory of special relativity. Because I claimed to him that actually the concept of prayer violated relativity theory, you see. And he said, no, no, no. We had a big discussion about this. And although he never actually agreed with me, he almost did. That's my useful mark there.
Well, I don't think it's a wave or a particle, but there's something else. Surely it's the way in which we in which God communicates with us and we communicate with God. I think to me the most important part of prayer is just resting in His presence and being aware of His presence.
Yes, Jim, could I add to, I mean, I made a slightly jocular remark. I make now a dead serious one, prayer. For many, many years at Imperial College, I was deeply involved in student welfare on a sort of one-to-one counselling basis, and many, many students came through my hands, and some of them were extremely disturbed. I had at least half a dozen people who were blatantly suicidal. And often I saw these students regularly, you know, once each week, something like that. If I couldn't get them to go to the doctor, which often you can't, that's all I could do. And sometimes I know that a student was coming, and I knew that it was going to be extremely difficult for me to do anything useful or to help. And on those occasions, I used to always pray beforehand for help. And it was extraordinary how often it worked. In fact, once, I had a really very profound mystical experience that actually, as it were, almost see an image of Christ sitting there. It's just, these things happen, you don't, I can't see what they mean, but it was like Christ was present helping me with these students. So prayer seems to me, it always, actually it does almost always work, is prayer for other people. Have you prayed for yourself? Like, can I get the Nobel Prize? It's not very effective.
It's now time to ask for our final comments from our speakers, beginning with Eric.
Yes, I'd like just to leave you with two thoughts. First of all, that science has revealed a universe of incredible beauty. Let's enjoy it and wonder at it. The second, though, is that to me the main division in society is not between different denominations or between different religions or between people with faith and without faith. The main division to me is between those who have a closed mind and those who have an open mind. And the closed mind cuts right across all faiths. Fundamentalism is rife across all faiths, and also across atheism. You find fundamentalist atheists as well. So, to me, it's important to encourage this open attitude and to encourage dialogue with other people who have an open attitude to life, regardless of what their faith is.
Francis.
If I, as a Christian, truly believe that in some sense God is the creator of everything that is, not as a craftsman, but in some mysterious way I do not understand, then that means that everything belongs to God. And that means that my husband, who's an agnostic scientist, actually mediates God's love to me, whether he acknowledges it or not. It also means that I cannot afford to turn my back on people who are different for whatever reason, because they have disabilities, because they are of a different religious faith, because they are of a different ethnicity. Whatever the reason, I cannot turn my back on someone who is also a creature of God. And so, for the last 48 hours, I have been engaged in a conference between Christians and Muslims around a remarkable document produced by 138 Muslim scholars and leaders a year ago called A Common Word. And the common word appealed to the Christian scriptures, love God and love your neighbour. And we have been talking together about the Quran and about the Bible and about our common belief that we are creatures of the one God who are called to love each other and to cross all boundaries in love towards one another.
Thank you, David.
I think we've come to see that we cannot help but seek for what is good and is true in everything we seek, and therefore we will inevitably look for traces of the Creator in creation. But the fact that we cannot identify those reminds us that creation is something quite other, yet quite fundamental to our life of inquiry. But if it is so fundamental, yet so preposterous to believe, why should we believe it? And one of the ways I have of trying to explain this to myself is that if we do believe that creation is freely a gift, that the universe is a gift, then we have at least have a chance of seeing our life as a vocation, as a call. Without that, I'm afraid we're stuck with a career.
Chris.
Would you like me, Mr. Chairman, to answer the question I was asked originally?
Yes.
Is it the point where I reveal all?
Yes.
Okay.
Shall I ask it again? Or will you
please
ask
it again.
Let me, we've got to find where it is now.
Do I think that?
Yes, do you think there is a divinely determined meaning and purpose embedded in the universe?
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
I could amplify if you want, but
We'll stick with that. Before we thank our speakers, let me remind you about the bookstall, the retiring collection, and the broadcast on Premier Radio. And our subject next week is stories of evolution, and the speakers include Steve Jones, who's hit the headlines over the last few days for his comments on evolution. So do come along. Thanks to those who submitted such excellent questions. I'm sorry we couldn't ask all of them. Thank you all for coming. And thanks to our speakers this evening for such a stimulating discussion.
That was Seeking Truth, Science, Mystery and Human Identity from St. Paul's Cathedral.